Welcome to Oncology Today, a special program focused on key presentations from the past year on the role of PARP inhibitors and immune checkpoint inhibitors in advanced ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Kathleen Katie Moore from the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center. To begin, Dr. Moore presented recent data on the use of PARP inhibitors in the frontline setting for ovarian cancer.
Well, thank you for joining this presentation today. It's my great privilege to really take us through kind of a rapid summary of really quite a bit of data that has been presented surrounding use of PARP inhibitors in epithelial ovarian cancer presented really since March 2020. So talking about things presented at ASCO and ESMO primarily, but also I'm going to talk a little bit about IGCS as well. So a lot has been presented in 2020 that we'll try and get through. We'll start with frontline ovarian cancer. And there really was an interesting update to an important trial. So I wanted to bring this to your attention. This actually isn't PARP inhibitors, but I think it helps us level set the benefit that PARP inhibitor maintenance brings. And this is the ICON-8 study. Now, ICON-8 was the most modern clinical trial done, big randomized clinical trial done, really just focusing on the chemotherapy backbone that we use in frontline ovarian cancer. There were absolutely no biologics included in this study. There was not stratification by BRCA. It's purely a study looking at, should you give paclitaxel carboplatin every 21 days with weekly paclitaxel or both drugs weekly. And Dr. Clamp had presented this originally a few years ago at ESMO and presented the progression-free survival data, which was the primary endpoint. And as you can see here, it really showed no difference between the three arms. And while it's certainly appropriate to use any of the three arms, there's really no justification from an efficacy standpoint to use potentially a more cumbersome weekly regimen over every 21-day paclitaxel and carboplatin. But I think it's important to show this just because it is in a modern era of medicine with our modern supportive medicines. This is what the progression-free survival curve looks like for advanced epithelial ovarian cancer when you just use paclitaxel and carboplatin. And so what you can see in the upper left-hand side is this shouldering that represents the 20% of women who progress within 6 months of completion of their chemotherapy and so are primary platinum resistant. And that shoulder has been there for time eternal since we've been using paclitaxel and carboplatin. We really haven't been able to impact on it until recently. And the other important thing to notice from this curve, and again, this curve looks like many other curves, is that by 3 years, about 80% of women have recurred. And while we have many, many things to use at the time of recurrence, and we'll talk about some of those today, patients are no longer curable. And so our biggest opportunity to impact is with improved interventions in the frontline. So this is sort of why I wanted to show the original PFS curve from ICON-8, but at ESMO, the overall survival data was also presented, and here is the data, not surprisingly, no difference in overall survival with any of the arms. Again, how do we impact on overall survival is multiple ways. A, prevent ovarian cancer altogether. B, come up with active agents and interventions in the recurrent setting. But C, and potentially most importantly, cure it in the frontline, which is what we're trying to do now. But this was an important update presented at ESMO, and I wanted to share it with you. So when we transition now from just a pure chemotherapy backbone to use of PARP inhibitors as switch maintenance in the frontline, we have 4 positive randomized trials that have been presented between 2018 and 2019. 1 year, 4 positive randomized studies. 3 of those studies, PRIMA, PAOLA, and VELIA, expanding indications for PARP inhibitor use beyond BRCA. But here I show you just the data from BRCA-associated cancers in each of these studies for progression-free survival. And all of them in their respective populations, which were different, demonstrated an unprecedented improvement in progression-free survival over the comparator. So very important and appropriately led to new FDA approvals in the United States and now globally. But the question here is about long-term follow-up. What about overall survival? And we don't have overall survival yet in frontline BRCA-associated cancers, but we do have updated longer-term follow-up from SOLO-1. And this was presented by Susanna Banerjee at ESMO and really is important data. So I'm showing you here the progression-free survival curve that we presented. Now, I'll remind you, in 2018, when we originally presented SOLO-1, we had 41 months of follow-up. and the hazard ratio was 0.3, and the median progression-free survival was not reached in the olaparib arm versus 13.3 months in the placebo arm. And so here now with 60 months of follow-up on the median, so 5 years of data, we do finally have an estimate for the median, which is 56 months for women who are randomized to olaparib versus still a consistent 13 plus months for the placebo arm. We also have these landmark analyses where you can see the differences in the percentages of women who remain disease-free in the olaparib cohort in red and in the placebo cohort in blue. And again, in 2018, we were able to present that 36-month landmark with 60 versus 27% of women remaining disease-free. And now at 5 years, we're at 48% and 21%. So the curves are really parallel here, and we don't see a tremendous amount of drop-off, reminding you that the vast majority of these patients stopped their assigned therapy way back at the two-year mark. We're really seeing a relatively flat curve here, which of course gives us hope that we've impacted overall survival, but time will tell, and that analysis is not due for another few years. Now, the other thing we looked at were some updated analyses of secondary efficacy endpoints, and those are shown here. On the left-hand side of your screen, progression-free survival 2 and time to second subsequent therapy, both of which remain very statistically significantly positive in favor of olaparib maintenance, including women who were in complete response at baseline, really just reiterating the fact that this therapy works regardless of your prognostic clinical indices at the conclusion of chemotherapy, complete response versus partial response, neoadjuvant versus primary cytoreduction. The magnitude of the benefit is the same, and we're showing that here. What I really wanted to bring to your attention was the safety profile with the longer term now, a median of 5 years of follow-up in SOLO 1. And really, we didn't see any emerging new adverse events. And so they are really what they were when we presented in 2018. But importantly, we've seen no additional occurrences of acute myelogenous leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome. So the three cases that were reported at the first analysis in 2018 remain the only three among women randomized in SOLO 1. We'll come back and talk about this point when we talk about the update from SOLO 2. So important updates from SOLO 1, it gives us some more confidence about the durability of the benefit we're seeing with use of frontline maintenance. Now, the other kind of big story was the approval of niraparib. And this was based on the PRIMA study, which was similar to SOLO 1 in a lot of ways, in that it enrolled women who had responded to frontline platinum-based chemotherapy, and then they were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to receive niraparib or placebo until progression or toxicity, or initially was the 3-year mark, although that's just been amended and it can be continued beyond that now. Now, they allowed for all comers to come on, so high-grade serous and high-grade endometrioid, and they stratified by homologous recombination deficiency, and the primary endpoint was progression-free survival in the intention to treat and the homologous recombination deficient population. Both of those were positive, and niraparib received an all-comer indication regardless of biomarker for women in the frontline. Now, the challenge with niraparib previously had been that there was really a relatively high incidence of severe thrombocytopenia. And this was noted in the recurrent studies, NOVA and QUADRA, et cetera. And it was discovered that the patients who were at highest risk for the severe thrombocytopenia were those women who were of low body weight, less than 77 kilograms, or who started with baseline platelets less than 150,000. And this was recognized. And so midway through PRIMA, the protocol was amended so that if you had either one of those criteria, your starting dose was 200 instead of starting at 300 and then dose reducing reactively to platelets. And so the question that everyone had was, how would that impact efficacy? If you looked at those patients who all started at 300 and then dose reduced if they needed it versus those that started at 200, were you missing kind of an efficacy bar here? So this is the analysis that Mansoor Mirza did to answer that question. And so what you can see here, so ISD is the individualized dosing. And the criteria, as I said, is body weight greater than or less than 77 kilograms and platelets greater than or less than 150,000 platelets in the starting dose for each of those criteria. And so when you look at the baseline demographics and tumor characteristics of the patients who received niraparib or placebo, and received what's FSD is flat starting dose versus the individualized starting dose in each of the arms, you can just look down and see that there really weren't any noticeable misdistribution of important prognostic variables between these two groups, because this wasn't a pre-specified endpoint. And so this is just a back of the napkin kind of look to make sure that all the stage four patients didn't end up in the flat dosing group versus the stage three patients. So it looks very much equivalent that the randomization took care and that important prognostic indices are very equitably distributed between patients who started and got flat starting dose versus those that came in at the time of the amendment. And so then, and the thing I just wanted to point out, and that's true of complete and partial response as well. So the first thing to look at is the progression-free survival hazard ratio and based on the starting dose subgroup. So again, flat starting dose versus individualized starting doses, the hazard ratios are 0.59 and 0.69, and those confidence intervals completely overlap, and there is no interaction. So we really believe that these are almost identical hazard ratios, and we don't see any difference in the hazard ratio for benefit in the entire population based on whether or not you started at 300 or you started at an individualized dose based on your weight and starting platelets. And you can see that here. And then they looked at the impact of flat dose versus individualized dose on adverse events. And the key kind of take-home box is here, where you look at thrombocytopenia, also anemia and neutropenia, but thrombocytopenia is really what we're looking at. When you start out with the flat starting dose, you see 48% of patients with any thrombocytopenia versus only 21% with individualized dosing. So it was cut by 60%. So really profound reduction in severe thrombocytopenia with use of this individualized starting dose. And then they did some other really interesting pharmacokinetics work, really just trying to get at this idea that if you started patients at a higher dose and had more drug exposure, that would correlate with better efficacy, for example. And so the fact that they looked at the different quartiles of drug exposure by PFS over time, and they all overlap, really kind of quashes that idea so that we can all feel, based on this, even though it's exploratory, very confident using the individualized dosing and not worrying that it's impacting the efficacy of niraparib on your patient. So this was an important poster, interestingly, at ASCO that Dr. Mirza presented. So that's the updates in frontline ovarian cancer. What's next? And what we're all hoping would be next, of course, is immunotherapy. And I think we're all a little bit disappointed. So the first study to present was JAVELIN, and this was actually presented at SGO. So this piece isn't new, but just to remind you, JAVELIN enrolled all comers, advanced stage ovarian cancer, all histologies, again, was not stratified by homologous recombination deficiency or BRCA or any immune markers, randomized to chemo with avelumab, and then chemo with avelumab and avelumab maintenance. And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. And we all have seen this data for progression-free and overall survival where there's absolutely no benefit to incorporation of avelumab. And in fact, there looks to be a little bit of a detriment to incorporation of avelumab. If you look at the gold progression-free survival curve on the left, that's avelumab followed by, or chemotherapy followed by avelumab. They all overlap, but that's on the wrong side of where you want to be, which was disappointing. Now, Dr. Letterman at IGCS presented the biomarker data from this study, which we were all really excited about because we wanted to see if there was a group that did benefit. And so, of course, they looked at patients who were PD-L1 positive and disappointingly, again, did not see a benefit. And interestingly, the group that got chemotherapy followed by avelumab looked to do a bit worse, but certainly no one benefited. I think we can see that clearly from these curves. They did the same analysis with CD8 without any evidence of benefit. And then also looking at BRCA, and I think we all remember that for a while, and there's really lovely preclinical data to suggest that women with BRCA mutations would have more neoantigens and would be more likely to respond to immune checkpoint inhibitors. This is really what we thought. And admittedly, there were a very small number of women with germline BRCA mutation associated cancers on JAVELIN 100. So take this with a grain of salt, but we absolutely did not see any signal of benefit for incorporation of avelumab into this subgroup. This is on the left, the BRCA associated cancers, and on the right is your wild type. So no benefit, unfortunately, seen. And so there was a lot of hope for Imagine 50. Now, this was presented at ESMO. So Imagine 50 was similar, enrolled all histologies except for mucinous. It's not stratified by homologous recombination deficiency or BRCA, but did stratify by PD-L1 status by the SP142 assay. And patients would receive paclitaxel, carboplatin, bevacizumab, and bevacizumab maintenance, or the same with atezolizumab, building on the idea that incorporating an anti-angiogenic agent with immune checkpoint inhibitors would increase T-cell trafficking to the tumor and take out some of the immune suppressive behaviors of vascular endothelial growth factor. And this concept had a lot of clinical evidence in other solid tumors, so we were very excited about Imagine 50. But unfortunately, it was not a positive study. On the left, you see the intention to treat, and on the right, you see the PD-L1 positive population. And we see a non-clinically significant improvement of 1.1 and 2.3 months, respectively, in each group. Now, there was an exploratory analysis done where we looked at how positive the PD-L1 was. So to be positive, it had to be greater than 1% on immune cells. That was the definition for the stratification factor. But what would it look like if we looked at patients who are 1 to 5 or greater than 5% positive immune cells? And so that's what I'm showing you here. If you look at the immune cells greater than 5%, here the hazard ratio is 0.64, and this is the curve that you see. And this is actually what we were expecting in the whole trial. So maybe this is perhaps a better biomarker to identify patients who will benefit, although this is exploratory and not yet controlled for important covariates inclusive of homologous recombination deficiency and BRCA. That analysis has been done and will hopefully be presented at Society of Gyn-Onc in March of 2021, so we can really show you who these patients were in terms of their homologous recombination deficiency status. So that's to be presented. So that's kind of the frontline story, so a lot presented. How about platinum-sensitive recurrent disease? Well, the first big thing to talk about is not actually chemo, but surgery. So desktop OVAR was presented, and this really was by Dr. Dubois, and this really was a practice-changing presentation. To remind you, these were patients who were at their first platinum-sensitive recurrence, and they had a positive AGO score. And that AGO score is listed here for you to see on the right. They had a great performance status. At their first surgery, it had to have been a primary surgery, and they had to have a complete cytoreduction. And at the time that they presented with their recurrence, they had to have really less than 500 cc's of ascites. So patients that met this score were randomized to undergo surgery followed by chemo or no surgery and then just go straight to chemo. And so importantly, this score was developed over time by Philip Harder, who I think first as a fellow did a retrospective study of their patients and started to identify what the predictive markers were for patients who had a successful secondary cytoreduction. And then they ran actually a smaller study called Desktop 2 to confirm the predictive value of this score. And then what they found in that study was that 51% of patients who had a positive AGO score, so of the patients who presented, 51% had a positive score. And then if they underwent surgery, 2/3 of them could have a complete resection. So this was the criteria for patients who went on desktop over. They had to have an AGO score. And these are just the characteristics of patients who were randomized to surgery or no surgery. And they were very well matched as appropriate by the randomization. But on the right-hand side, what you can see are the surgical details. And these were really complex surgeries. They took quite a bit of time. There was quite a bit of GI resection involved. These were not sort of chip shot surgeries. So done by highly qualified surgeons, I think is my point. And of patients, just like their phase 2 suggested, of patients who had a positive AGO score, they were able to get to complete resection 2/3 of the time, 74.2%. But what did that mean? What did that translate into? Well, here's the overall survival curve comparing patients who didn't get surgery. So 53.7 versus 46 months. So basically a year longer of overall survival if they were randomized to surgery. But even more interestingly, if you look at the patients who got surgery, these are only surgical patients, those that were completely resected versus those who had an incomplete resection. So 61 versus 28 months. So it just really speaks to the importance of good selection because the patients who are incompletely resected, we probably harmed. They live less long. And so really good selection. So we really are optimizing who we take to the OR so we get them completely resected to get this benefit is really key. And then here's another subgroup analyses of no surgery versus surgery with complete resection, 61 versus 46 months. So 46 months for no surgery versus 28 months who had surgery and they couldn't get it all out. So again, we may be harming people if we're not selecting well. But if we select well, we buy them at least a year, potentially longer of life. So this was very much practice changing in my world. And I think we're still thinking about this, but important to mention. So that's just surgery. Now, how about therapeutics? We've all known the story of maintenance PARP inhibitors, regardless of biomarker. There's a gradation of benefit, but there's a benefit in all biomarker subgroups. We've known this. This isn't new data. We've known it in the, I told you the BRCA story in frontline. We first knew the BRCA story in platinum sensitive recurrence via SOLO2, NOVA, and ARIEL 3. All, again, unprecedented improvements in progression-free survival in the recurrent setting. But the question is, what about overall survival? These studies resulted a few years ago. So what do we know about overall survival? Well, we now have overall survival from SOLO2, which was all BRCA-associated cancers, first or second platinum-sensitive recurrence, randomized to olaparib or placebo. All of these patients were PARP naive, importantly, a population that's probably going away. But here you see a 13-month improvement in the median overall survival with use of olaparib. And this is even more striking when you consider the fact that almost 40% of the patients appropriately crossed over to receive a PARP in a subsequent line of therapy. And we still see this over a year improvement in the median progression-free survival, which speaks to the importance of sequencing earlier. This tells us use PARP earlier, don't wait, because you can't catch patients up later. 40% of patients got it later, and we still didn't catch up this curve. So earlier use makes a lot of sense, and a year longer overall survival, again, a very important presentation from ASCO. Now, it did come with a little caveat, a little caret, in that we did see more myelodysplastic syndrome and acute myelogenous leukemia in the group of patients who had been randomized to olaparib. So at the time of primary analysis, it was pretty equal between the groups, 2 and 4%. Now it's 8 and 4%. And the additions were all among patients who were kind of post-safety follow-up, meaning they had gone on to other therapies. And so this is something we're really interested in studying, why this happens. It is likely much related to repetitive use of platinums. I'm not saying it's not related to the PARP inhibitor. I'm sure that's contributory, but it may be more related to how many lines of platinum someone has had. This is an area of active investigation right now. And there's actually a very interesting publication coming out soon that y'all should take a look at in Lancet. But we really are trying to figure out who's at risk here. So the overall survival really would tell us that this is the standard of care, but we really have to have our antennas up for patients who are at risk for MDS and AML. But it also makes the finding in SOLO 1 that I told you about that we didn't see any additional AML or MDS with longer follow-up. You're using it in the frontline and preventing, hopefully, the need for additional platinums. We may not see this similar bump over time. Again, time will tell as we have here, they have 7 years of follow-up. So the jury's still out here, but definitely something we have to keep our antennas up for. So how about, there's been a lot of interest in not using chemo in platinum-sensitive recurrent disease. Let's just go right to PARP inhibitors. And we have this data, single-arm studies that show a nice response rate and nice durability. So can we replace chemo? Well, Joyce Liu, Dr. Liu and the NRG tried to answer this with NRG GY004. This was presented at ASCO. First platinum-sensitive recurrence randomized to olaparib or olaparib-cediranib, again, trying to build on that synergy between antiangiogenics and PARP versus chemo. Now, potentially the fatal flaw here is that there wasn't chemo followed by PARP. It was just chemo and stop, and we'll talk about that. But this was the design. Can you replace chemotherapy? And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. And here are the curves. And so what you can see, progression-free and overall survival on the left and right, respectively, is that there's really no statistical difference between progression-free survival amongst any of the three arms for either progression-free or overall survival. Now, what I want to point out is that chemotherapy, which is the blue line, stops where this arrow is. And so what I wonder is if we did now what is modern medicine and added a PARP after, whether or not that blue line actually would have been superior. I have that question. I think we all do. It's speculative, but what would have happened if they got chemo plus PARP? Would we really say this is an inferior strategy to replace chemo with PARP? Right now, we can't say that. And then she also looked at patients who had BRCA-associated cancers on the left. Again, these are PARP naive. And then on the right are patients who are BRCA wild type. And there really was not a statistically relevant difference between the groups to argue for changing the standard of care in platinum-sensitive recurrent disease. It remains a backbone of platinum with maintenance therapy. So very important study. Now, what's next in that attempt to replace chemo may be what was presented in Mediola. So Mediola was presented at ESMO just really recently, which is a bigger study. They presented the BRCA wild type cohort, and it has two cohorts within that. One is looking at olaparib plus durvalumab, and the other one's looking at olaparib, durvalumab, and bevacizumab. So triplet versus doublet. This is a small cohort, 31 and 32 patients, basically single arm kind of studies looking at response rate to see what the signal is. So you have to take this a little bit with a grain of salt, but this is interesting. So here are the patients, these are platinum sensitive BRCA wild type in both groups. Look at the responses in that triplet arm. Basically every single person had some reduction in their tumor dimensions and the overall response rate was 87%. Not too shabby. And that confidence interval isn't that wide. But even more interestingly to me, if you look at the bottom table, is those patients who are classified as genomic instability or HRD. This is HRD. So if they were classified as homologous recombination proficient, you still saw a benefit in the triplet that you didn't see in the doublet. So if you were homologous recombination deficient or GIS positive, it was 100% response rate, which is kind of amazing. 75% if you're homologous recombination proficient, and then 84% if you're unknown, versus 50%, 17%, and 31%. So these look different enough that there may be something to this triplet. So this may be something we keep our eyes on in terms of another potential opportunity to replace chemotherapy in this setting, but a bigger randomized study would have to confirm that. But I'm pretty excited about this data set. In platinum insensitive or heavily pretreated epithelial ovarian cancer, we did have some nice data, not so much related to PARP inhibitors, but things that I think you should be aware of. Dr. Lucy Gilbert at ASCO presented a nice study, again, looking at the antibody drug conjugate mirvetuximab, which targets folate receptor alpha, in combination with bevacizumab. And this was done irrespective of platinum sensitivity. So patients could have a definition of being platinum resistant, or they could be quote unquote platinum sensitive. These folks that maybe have had platinum many times or were platinum insensitive, PFI of 7 or 8 months, you could enroll them all to the study if you didn't think platinum was the best option for your patient. So it was a little bit kind of a basket in terms of eligibility. Very well tolerated as we expect with the combination, and patients had received appropriate therapies as you would expect in a phase one study. But here you can see, again, this waterfall plot where basically almost every patient has responded to the combination in some way with some tumor shrinkage and then confirmed rhesus responses in a very high number of patients, consistent with what we reported in Forward One. The highest likelihood of responding were those with high folate receptor alpha expression, 64% overall response rate. Platinum sensitive status, interestingly, really didn't impact response here. It was 59% in platinum resistant and 69% platinum sensitive. So both seem to respond equally as well to this combination. And so as mirvetuximab continues its path towards a regulatory approval, we hope this combination with bevacizumab actually may be an option for patients who want, it's not really chemo-free because it's an antibody-drug conjugate, but another option for a bevacizumab combination that doesn't have the chemotherapy side effects. So this is a nice study and hopefully will be in manuscript status soon. Now, we're still, of course, interested in immune checkpoint inhibitors in ovarian cancer, just trying to find a space for them. This was presented by Dr. Ursula Matulonis at ASCO. That was the kind of final analysis from the KEYNOTE 100 study, which is a really big study of monotherapy pembro, lizumab, in women with recurrent ovarian cancer and looking at different cut points. Again, we're trying to find the biomarker, and they really focused on the CPS score for this particular study. We talked about PD-L1 positivity with Imagine 50. Here it's the combined positivity score. And if you have a CPS greater than 10, there was a suggestion that that really was the group who potentially could benefit the most from monotherapy immune checkpoint inhibitors. And you see the overall survival curves listed here on the right. And the response is 18% in that CPS of 10, a modest effect. I think we can agree that probably monotherapy immune checkpoint inhibitors are not super active, at least in terms of how we identify patients thus far. But it is here in the CPS greater than 10, maybe an interesting target. But the question is this as good as monotherapy chemo, which we all say is totally inactive in a platinum-resistant population? Should we just be using this instead? We actually had a randomized study presented at ESMO, so this is important. Randomized patients with platinum-resistant ovarian cancer to nivolumab, a different immune checkpoint inhibitor, but we think just as good, or chemo, gemcitabine or pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And primary endpoint was overall survival. Secondary endpoint was progression-free. So overall survival, you see on the left, there was absolutely no difference between nivolumab and either gemcitabine or PLD. But if you look at PFS, actually, the patients who randomized to nivolumab did worse than chemotherapy. And so I'm not arguing that chemotherapy is super active, but nivolumab does not at all appear to be superior. And we needed this randomized study to be done really to say that. So I think this was important. Other opportunities to use immune checkpoint inhibitors may be in combinations. And so this is the LEAP-005 study, which is a big basket looking at a number of tumors with pembrolizumab and lenvatinib, which we all know has great activity in endometrial cancer. The question is, does it have activity in other gynecologic cancers? So this study had a number of solid tumors, including ovary cancer. And so here is the data for ovary and triple negative breast, small numbers, 31 patients, but a 32% response rate, fourth line ovarian. So that's not too shabby. I think we would all agree that's pretty compelling. And the duration of overall response or duration of response was not reached. So it appears durable, small numbers. So this may be a combination worth exploring in the recurrent ovarian cancer setting. And I hope that additional studies are being planned. And with that, I will conclude my talk.
Just a couple of follow-up questions. So pembro lenvatinib, is it your take that it's going to be active?
I think so. I mean, it's certainly active in endometrial cancer in a setting where really nothing has worked. And I think as we are really getting far better at dosing and managing the adverse events for our patients so that they can stay on with good quality of life, it's really been quite transformational. I was a little bit dubious of it because of the adverse events initially, and I am definitely converted. 32% is a nice response rate among women who are fairly heavily pretreated with their ovarian cancer. If you remember, the original olaparib approval was in patients who'd received at least 3 lines of chemo. They got olaparib, and there was a 31% response rate amongst BRCA-associated cancers. And that's 2 standard deviations over what we expect. So this is 32%. Still 2 standard deviations over what you expect. I mean, you're not even talking about BRCA-associated cancers. So it needs bigger numbers. It needs a bigger study. But if I were offered that study, I would definitely take it because I think it could be good for patients.
Is there a study out there right now that's looking at this?
That basket study, I think, has some different cohorts that are still expanding larger numbers. So I do believe there are still some ongoing attempts to get bigger numbers. You can get a better confidence interval around that response rate and really make sure that it's truly where we think it is. As far as I know, there has not been a randomized study launched in ovary yet, but we're certainly waiting and interested.
Do we know what lenvatinib does in ovary?
There have actually been studies of single agent lenvatinib, and it's not inactive, but it's not 32%.
Another question. I thought what you showed looks kind of encouraging.
Oh, yeah. Mirvetuximab is definitely still here. We have launched the single agent study. There's actually 2 big studies ongoing right now. Mirasol, which is the randomized phase 3 in platinum resistant ovarian cancer, up to 3 priors who are folate receptor alpha high. Now, FORWARD-1, I think you thought mirvetuximab was gone because FORWARD-1 was negative, which is true. But FORWARD-1, the fatal flaw there was that how the scoring was done for folate receptor alpha, which was a key component of eligibility was flawed. And so there were many patients enrolled to Forward One who were actually ineligible. And there were many patients classified as folate receptor alpha high who were not high. And it just kind of nullified our study. And so we went back to the drawing board. We have a lot of confidence in our current scoring methodology and are only enrolling those patients who are folate receptor alpha high. And I really believe, I am biased because I'm the PI, so I have to say that, but I really believe in the study and I believe it's going to be positive. In parallel with that, SORIA is running, Dr. Robert Coleman runs that. So that's a single arm study, similar population, except patients have to have been pretreated with bevacizumab, but that is an accelerated approval attempt for mirvetuximab. It's an active drug as a monotherapy. We just have to have the biomarker. Biomarkers are key. We learned that in Imagine. We're learning that here. So this combination data with Bev was done with the appropriate scoring methodology, and you're seeing those really high response rates, which mirror what you see with Aurelia and maybe is better tolerated. So I think that may be a path forward in the future once the drug is approved. Aurelia was the first study to establish combination bevacizumab and chemo, paclitaxel, topo, or PLD. That combination was more active than monotherapy chemo. And so that kind of set, that is the standard of care for 1 to 2 priors platinum-resistant disease.
So you're saying Mirva plus Bev?
Yeah, Mirva plus Bev was the study that was presented by Dr. Gilbert. Very tolerable and very high response rates. Single arm study. So you have to take everything with a grain of salt. So I can't say, oh, it's as good as Aurelia, but certainly those response rates and the duration of responses that we are seeing are on par with what we see with Aurelia. And so if that were true, that gives you an opportunity to use potentially a better tolerated combination in that setting. So time will tell.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
One more question. When you were talking about SOLO 2 and the MDS data, can you explain a little bit more about the two time periods?
So there's like an established safety period, which extends for 30 days after you come off of any study. So you'll follow patients for like another 30 days once they've reached an endpoint. And then that's sort of the safety period. And then there's kind of the post period when you're following folks long term and you're still collecting these particular adverse events of special interest, such as AML or MDS. So when the original time period was when the data cut point came, there was 2% and 4% incidences of AML or MDS in the olaparib and placebo group, respectively. There are a few more in the placebo group, interestingly. Now, when you roll in now years more of follow-up in these patients, we picked up a total of 8% of patients who were randomized to olaparib and then later developed AML or MDS kind of in longer term follow-up. And so that is higher than what we see in the placebo group with the same longer term follow-up. Now, the questions we have to ask ourselves are, what was causative here? Was the PARP inhibitor causative? Was it the fact that these patients who received olaparib did so well, they got another line of platinum or 2 lines of platinum? They were certainly alive at least a year longer than the other group. So there's more opportunity to develop AML or MDS the longer you live. So there are things that are associated and things that are causative. And so I think we still have to really figure that out in ovarian cancer. When you look across the board at treatment-related myeloid neoplasms, because you see those in many settings, fortunately uncommon, but you do see them, there is a little bit of a correlation with a rise in those treatment-related myeloid neoplasms and increased use of platinums in many solid tumors. And so there is a hypothesis that it is related to the number of platinums in part. Again, I am not saying it's not related to the PARP. Please don't mishear me. But I think there's more to the story. It's not just a PARP issue.
I guess I'm trying to even understand the implication.
The implication is really, it's really providing information. Because when the study was presented, like every other study, we said there's not much AML MDS. It was 2% and 4%. And people said, okay, that's in range with every other PARP study, low, but it doesn't make me not use a PARP. And then a longer term follow-up that became 8%, which is higher. That's the highest AML MDS we've ever reported in any study of PARP, but this has the longest follow-up. So I think the implication is that we just really need to understand who's at risk for developing AML-MDS and whether or not we can predict it? And also, would you not use a PARP? How do you adjudicate what to do, or do you not use platinum? So I think it's just pointing out that we're keeping women alive longer. Maintenance therapies, including bevacizumab, are kind of prolonging the progression-free survival. And so I think patients are getting more platinum than they ever did before because we keep pushing them out and making them quote-unquote platinum sensitive again. And that, plus the use of other DNA damaging agents, may be pushing up our rates of AML-MDS. Plus, this group has BRCA-associated cancers, and patients with germline BRCA are already at a higher risk for AML-MDS than those who are BRCA wild type. So this is just, I think, the implications are that it's there. It's probably higher than any of us think. And we're starting to get accurate numbers of what the risk really is. But what's directly causative and what's associated, we need to parse out.
It's just that I've heard people look at these data and say, that's why I think about not duration, keeping somebody on it for 5 years. I think about it because of this. But to me, that's not what this is saying, because you don't see it later.
Right. I think that that's not what, however you want to read this, that's not what it's saying. I hear that too. I don't think that that's accurate. I don't think it's how long you've been on the PARP. I think it's how many lines of therapy you've had.
Absolutely.
So honestly, in the front line, if you cure patients or you markedly improve their PFS so they're not getting a million other lines of therapy, we may not see this as much, but time will tell.
Okay, so let's go to your cases.
So this is one of my actually most beloved patients. She presented at age 41 and had had some really mild abdominal symptoms, but she's a tremendous athlete, very fit, and recognized that her body shape was changing. And so went in actually with a palpable nodule in her belly button, went into her PCP in 2013 and had a biopsy that came back with high-grade serous carcinoma. And so then got referred to me. On imaging, she had what appeared to be very low volume disease. We already had a pathologic diagnosis at the time. And really, we had to talk through, she has a big family, but was not married, had not had children yet. And so we really had to work through all the issues of whether or not she wanted to try and preserve eggs and do any kind of fertility preservation. But ultimately, she decided that she just wanted to do a complete cytoreductive surgery. And so that what we did a little later in April 2013. She had FIGO stage 3B, high-grade serous ovarian cancer, which means both of her ovaries were involved, and she had small volume disease at her kind of right at her belly button. It wasn't a node. We call that a Sister Mary Joseph node. It was just the omentum. She's so thin, just stuck to her belly button, just a little bit of nodularity. So very low volume. So she was completely cytoreduced to no gross residual disease. She underwent genetic counseling and genetic testing once we had a diagnosis and was found to have a germline BRCA mutation as well. And all of her family has subsequently been tested, and we have several other known carriers now as well. She was treated on a clinical trial at that time, which combined paclitaxel, carboplatin, and bevacizumab with a PARP inhibitor known as veliparib. And this particular trial was incorporating veliparib only with the chemo and not as maintenance, which we now know is the best way to use it, but followed by 15 cycles of bevacizumab as maintenance. And she finished that in August of 14 and really did amazing. She just fit young woman, did great, finished with no evidence of any disease, and really was living her life as a professional until March of 2019, when her previously normal and very low CA125 started to rise. We started watching her with imaging quite a bit more closely and eventually discovered what appeared to be an oligometastasis on the surface of her liver, which is what I'm showing you here. So on the CT scan on the right, you can see the oligomet on the liver. It's right up there where the white arrow is. And on the PET scan, you can see the area on the liver lighting up. It's pretty clear there. So both on PET and on CT, she had no other evidence of disease at all, and she was completely asymptomatic. And so we elected to do a secondary cytoreductive surgery. We talked about the AGO criteria earlier today, but she really met all of the criteria to be considered for a secondary cytoreductive surgery. She had excellent performance status, no ascites, and had a primary cytoreductive surgery to no gross residual, and on imaging had disease that appeared very resectable. And so this was resected. It actually wasn't on the liver. It looks like it's on the liver, but it was actually stuck to the diaphragm, and her liver was completely uninvolved. And so she had a partial resection of her diaphragm with closure, and then started chemotherapy with carboplatin and pegylated liposomal doxorubicin for 6 cycles, was NED at the conclusion of 6 as she started, and then started olaparib 300 milligrams twice a day in February of 2020, and continues on therapy now and continues to be without evidence of disease and no dose reductions. So doing really well, and I'm going to continue this for a very long time. I presented this case as I took care of her way back in 2013, but let's change it and say she's presented to you now. And she's come in, she's this healthy 41-year-old, and you discover this BRCA-associated cancer. She undergoes a cytoreduction to no gross residual. How would you, in the audience, how would you treat her? What would you be thinking about for her in terms of backbone chemotherapy? Would you be using bevacizumab? Would you be using a PARP inhibitor? If so, which one? What would be your strategy for managing my patient? So I think for me, if she presented to me today, I for 100% sure would be talking to her very early on about the fact that we're going to be using a PARP inhibitor for maintenance for 2 years. And I tend to use olaparib in this setting, as that was the first approved PARP inhibitor in BRCA-associated cancers. I think the question of adding bevacizumab is a really important one. We certainly have 2 studies. We have SOLA-1 and we have PAOLA, both with data in BRCA-associated cancers that show an unprecedented improvement over the comparison. In SOLA-1, the comparison is placebo. And in PAOLA, the comparison is bevacizumab. And they're different populations. And all you can say is the hazard ratio shows an unprecedented improvement in both. So the nice thing about PAOLA is that PAOLA has done some interesting subset analyses looking at quote unquote higher risk and lower risk ovarian cancer. I would just like to say that all ovarian cancer is high risk, but I know these criteria exist where high risk are stage 4 and neoadjuvant and suboptimal, and low risk are these stage 3 primary, no evidence of disease, et cetera. But PAOLA looked at those 2 groups and really found that bevacizumab and olaparib had sort of an equal magnitude of benefit, regardless of how you classify someone by risk. So I like the combination. It is a little more toxic. So I would talk to her about adding in bevacizumab once she had recovered from surgery, and then adding in the olaparib after versus just sticking with chemotherapy and doing monotherapy PARP. I would have a conversation with her about what we know. But I do like the combination, I'm not going to lie. More is more, I think. So we talked about what we would do today with this patient, which is definitely different than what we did in 2013. Let's take it a step further, kind of in her course. What you saw here is that she recurred about 5 years later after she finished bevacizumab with this oligometastasis that ended up being at her diaphragm. So assuming that we treated her with chemotherapy and PARP maintenance, and now she's recurred 3 years after PARP maintenance with this oligometastasis, apparent oligometastasis, how would you have looked at treating her? What would have been your sequence of events for treating our patient? Would you still take her to the operating room or have someone take her to the operating room to resect this? Yes or no? What would have been your choice for systemic chemotherapy for her? And what do you think about her maintenance options? Is she someone you're going to try PARP inhibitor retreatment in? Is she someone you're going to move straight to bevacizumab and chemo and bevacizumab in, assuming that we didn't use bevacizumab in the frontline, or even if we did, are you going to reuse bevacizumab? What are your options for treating her and optimizing her outcome? Had I treated her initially with a PARP inhibitor, really with or without bevacizumab, I think that's immaterial because we know bevacizumab works when you use it again and again. Someone that has recurred after 3 years or 4 years or whatever off of a PARP and has a resectable metastasis, regardless of BRCA status, I'm going to be looking to have them taken back to the operating room. So I think the data from Desktop OVAR is very compelling in that setting and something we should consider in appropriately selected patients. So I would definitely do that again. And I'm really glad we did it in my patient now. Then I would retreat her probably with the same backbone. I really like pegylated liposomal doxorubicin and carbo. It's so convenient and it works really well. I think the question of maintenance is a tough one. We don't have any data and we have to acknowledge that. We do not have any data for retreatment. However, in a patient who did not progress on a PARP inhibitor and had many years off of a PARP inhibitor, and especially someone that had a BRCA-associated cancer, I would likely reuse PARP inhibitor maintenance. I might use a different one. I mean, as long as we're doing things without data, I would just really keep it going and use a different PARP. And I would treat likely until recurrence in that setting. I wouldn't limit it to only 2 years. So I have to say that is what I would do. That is not the NCCN recommendation. So we have to say that out loud because I'm talking to my colleagues in the field. Sometimes you do things without data because data is pending. So we'll have those studies resulting soon. Oreo is, I believe, close to accrual and is trying to answer the question of PARP after PARP. And others are looking at this. But I would probably reuse a PARP until I knew that that PARP was not going to work.
Let's go to your next case.
So this is an anemia case. This is another one of my patients, again, with a BRCA-associated cancer. She's very young, 47 when she presented with stage 3, very bulky, high-grade serous ovarian cancer. She underwent an extensive cytoreduction, fortunately to no gross residual, and then was treated with 6 cycles of paclitaxel and carboplatin, which she tolerated pretty well. She had quite a bit of just mild fatigue, mild neuropathy, but overall did okay. She tolerated therapy all right. And because she had a BRCA-associated cancer, we started her on olaparib maintenance at the starting dose of 300 milligrams. We waited about 8 weeks after chemotherapy, which I would just say is an important point. You don't need to start immediately after finishing chemotherapy, like cycle 7, kind of start PARP. You can give folks a little bit of time. All the studies allowed 6 to 9 weeks. So I usually try and get it started like 6 to 8 weeks. Just to give them a little bit of time to feel better. And she really needed that. She just had been really mentally hit by this diagnosis. So we started it. The plan was to continue for 2 years per the protocol and then discontinue because of the unprecedented improvement in progression-free survival. But she really struggled with the olaparib, I will say. We started it and 4 days later, I had clinic on Monday. So Thursday of that week, she called that she was having daily nausea. It was impacting her ability to eat and really was not tolerating the therapy well. So we brought her back in. We wanted to make sure, because she was still recently post-chemo, wanted to make sure there wasn't something else going on, that she hadn't gotten some exposure, food poisoning, something like that. But we really did feel like it was the PARP. So we held her for 3 days. It could be 4 days, it could be 2 days. I just do 3. There's no magic to that. But I think the point is dose interruption is really helpful here. Just give them a little break to let the nausea go away and reset. And now I do this routinely. I send patients home with antiemetics, but I added an antiemetic to her. You can use whatever you like. And so I pre-treated with an antiemetic, and that worked much better. She really tolerated things much better. And a few months in, we were able to wean off that antiemetic so she didn't have to take quite so many pills once we'd gotten her body acclimated to the pills. So just that little bit of an interruption and adding in an antiemetic made the difference for her. She cruised along until about 6 months into therapy, and her hemoglobin was 8.2, which is grade 2. She was asymptomatic. She's a young person, and it had been this gradual drop. So we really didn't need to do anything at that point. We worked her up for iron deficiency and B12 deficiency, which I think is really key. Our patients are notorious for having low iron, at least in my part of the world, and we just miss it. So it's really important to work that up because sometimes you can just add iron and they just rebound and do so much better. She didn't have anything. She's actually a super health nut. So her iron and B12 are fine. We just kept treating her and watching her labs and she kind of stabilized. But about a year into therapy, she dropped a little bit more. She was a little bit fatigued. Rest of her lab panel was okay. But this is really where you get to grade 3 hemoglobin and you do have to do something. You just can't keep treating someone at that level. So you can either dose hold and let it rebound over a few weeks and then restart at a dose modification, or you can transfuse and then immediately go to a dose modification, which is what I did. So I just transfused her and then I brought her down to 250. You can come all the way down to 200, but I like to step it down to 250 so I can maintain dose intensity. Like she didn't get to this point for a year. So you can be a little bit more gradual with your dose modifications as compared to somebody that, I guess this would be a good question for the audience. If you had this patient, but 2 months into therapy, she comes in with a hemoglobin of 8.2, what would you have done? Would you have done something different? Would you have dose modified her, transfused her? How would you have dealt with that kind of earlier development of anemia, grade 2 anemia on olaparib? And then same question, how would you have dealt with a 7, a year into therapy? What would you have been thinking about in terms of your workup and concerns about this patient? So I think those are the things to think about. For me, I like to really look at the rate of decline. So like in this patient, it was really gradual. I'm always trying to make sure that I'm not missing iron deficiency, B12, GI bleeds, just normal stuff. And I try to maintain dose intensity as much as possible because I think it's important. In patients who are really sensitive, and you'll run into them, the average time to see anemia is right at the beginning of month three. So 2 months in, that's really where you're going to start to see the anemia if it's going to happen. So patients that really drop fast, or they drop, you transfuse them and you dose modify a little bit and then they drop again. Those are folks that I may take down to 200 or even to 150, let them ride for a while, and then I'll try and eke them back up and get to the sweet spot where their hemoglobin is closer to 9. So I'm much more aggressive with my dose modifications depending on the rate of drop. So I think you have to just get comfortable with that.
I'm reflecting back on an interview I did with Dr. DeBono, and I don't know if he was talking about anemia specifically, but he brought up the issue of mini drug holidays rather than dose reduction, letting the patient take off for a couple of weeks. What do you think about that strategy? Ever do that?
So I think dose interruptions are really helpful with, especially when we're going to have someone on a maintenance therapy for years and they're struggling. So I think dose interruptions really can help avoid unnecessary dose reductions that do take away some of the dose intensity, with the caveat being drugs don't work unless you take them. And so we have to balance too many drug holidays for unnecessary reasons with trying to keep people, if someone's going to keep skipping repeatedly, I'd rather bring them down so they can be continuously on a dose. There is data that Mark O'Connor has presented, I think a poster form, where early on they looked at intermittent dosing of PARP inhibitors as opposed to continuous dosing. And it really does not work as well. So planned intermittent dosing, like, well, I'm going to have her do it 5 days on, 2 days off. For PARP inhibitors, if that's the best you can do, that's the best you can do. And I'd rather use it, but I wouldn't plan to do that because we know it's an inferior way to give the drug. And that's different than like TKIs, where medical oncologists are really very facile at adjusting how these drugs are dosed so that patients can stay on without terrible side effects. And they use a lot of the intermittent dosing without impact on efficacy. So that's important. It's probably not your best strategy in PARP.
So as long as we're on the topic of PARP toxicity, are there any questions you'd like to throw out there to the audience about their experiences or what they do?
Well, I just like to ask my colleagues when I'm talking to them at these meetings, which are great, these virtual meetings, how they counsel patients or how they have instructed their clinical pharmacists or their nurse practitioners, who often are right and left hand in clinic, how they counsel patients who are starting a PARP inhibitor. How do they set expectations for that patient so that she really feels empowered to understand what she's going to feel like on a PARP and can respond appropriately to things that should be escalated and things that she should have rescue medications for at home. So for example, how are you counseling somebody about the nausea? Because it can be really daunting to sit and tell a patient, well, yeah, 70% of patients on PARP, they have nausea and they've just come off chemotherapy where they were nauseated and they hate being nauseated because it feels terrible to be nauseated. And they're like, well, that doesn't sound like a good thing at all. Maybe I don't want that drug. So how do you accurately present what is the reality of a PARP inhibitor with the contingencies of how we address toxicities, the grade, how women have tolerated the drug, both on clinical trial and in real world analyses, so that, again, women understand what could happen, but also aren't frightened going into taking an oral therapy, which many of them have never taken an oral therapy. So I think that's sort of the thing I like to learn from my colleagues is how they go about counseling women. Do they use prophylactic? Do they send patients home right off the bat with antiemetics? Do they just instruct them that if they need one to call and then their office is ready to send it in? How do they counsel around fatigue? And what are your strategies when someone calls and they're like, ooh, I'm so tired? How are you addressing sleep hygiene and ways to combat fatigue? And what's in your toolbox for fatigue, which is just so hard to fix? But we can do some things that help.
Any questions you want to throw back to them in terms of their experiences with insomnia?
I think that we're really interested in trying to do better with assessing sleep hygiene across the board in all patients with cancer, but we're specifically talking about ovarian cancer today. And I think we all recognize that sleep hygiene is often poor in our patients just at baseline. Without cancer, as we age, sleep hygiene becomes really a big problem. And patients who don't get rest, or people who don't get rest, have more issues with pain and more issues with depression at baseline. And then you throw cancer and a cancer therapy on top of that, that maybe can exacerbate insomnia, which some of the PARPs really can. About 20% of patients report insomnia with a PARP inhibitor. And whether or not it's the PARP or PARP plus other things, because we're asking the questions, who cares? We're finding out that the patient isn't sleeping well, which definitely makes their fatigue worse and their pain worse and everything else. So I think we all know that it exists, but it's so challenging to intervene upon and work up. And I think we tend to maybe not ask the question. So I'm always curious how my colleagues are assessing sleep hygiene amongst their patients in general. What are their tips and tricks for patients? Do they send everyone to a sleep study? We use a lot of melatonin here because Oklahomans like to use things that are a little more natural sometimes. So melatonin is really popular here, something they can just use that's over the counter. Feels less like a medicine to them. And that worked pretty well. Sleepy time tea, that's my thing for patients. I recommend sleepy time tea. So I think just asking the question and letting the patient tell you their story and then trying to do something that shows that you are addressing it sometimes goes a long way just towards helping patients feel a little more control of their situation.
Do you think that PARP inhibitors cause insomnia?
I do. I think especially niraparib, because it has the palpitations, which I think patients feel a little jittery. It's not all of them, like 15%. But I do think that that contributes to this little bit hyped up kind of side effect that in a vulnerable patient can make them a little more apt to not sleep. But you do see it in olaparib and rucaparib too, absolutely reported. So it's not just a niraparib issue.
I started asking people because last year I was reading Rob Coleman's paper on toxicity, and he brought up the issue of PARP affecting circadian rhythm.
Oh, yeah. I think we just don't even understand all the things that it does to patients. But, and it's probably true of so many of the drugs we use impacting sleep hygiene. I don't think it's just a PARP story.
Any questions you want to pose to people about how they counsel patients about MDS?
When I counsel patients for PARP inhibitor, I really go through kind of the big three: fatigue, nausea, and vomiting. And then I talk a little bit about dyspepsia and dysgeusia and just interventions for that. But I do mention that there is a potential for AML and MDS. In the frontline, I'm still quoting the 1% to 2% risk. And I do really look at how, and I think we all do, how our patients did on the frontline therapy. So folks that sort of barely got through without growth factor support and three delays, that's someone I'm going to be worried about, honestly, using a PARP. And I may actually have them see my hematology colleagues first. I'm fortunate enough at an academic center, they're right down the hall. And they've looked at, and they'll do a bone marrow if they think it's indicated. We have, unfortunately, identified a few patients with de novo MDS that's not treatment related. That's unusual. But I do really pay attention to those things now. But I tell patients about it just so that they know and can ask questions and feel fully informed. But I'd be interested to know what my colleagues in the community and other academic centers do, and if it changes frontline therapy versus someone that you're counseling to use it in platinum-sensitive recurrence, or even patients in a quadra-type setting, heavily pretreated, homologous recombination deficient, you're going to try and use something that you're going to use for as long as it works. Does your counseling about AML, MDS change in those different settings or not? And how do you balance the unknowns without counseling appropriately, without raising unnecessary fears in your patient, I think is a challenge.
Any other final questions you'd be curious about in terms of what people are doing in terms of ovarian cancer, particularly related to PARP?
I would ask the audience, given the plethora of studies that have resulted between 2018 and 2019, four frontline studies with PARP and now two with immunotherapy, I'm interested to know from our community colleagues and our academic colleagues, what study has been the most impactful to them in terms of how it changed their practice? What really spoke to you from all this data that came out? Was it just SOLO-1 and BRCA? What are you all thinking about the idea of testing for homologous recombination deficiency? What test are you sending? Why? And if you're not testing, why? What is it about the data that makes you not want to test? Niraparib is available for everyone. So do you kind of think you don't need a test, which you don't, to use it? Does it help you with counseling? I really enjoy starting to hear about how folks have interpreted the this data and how they're bringing it into their practice and taking care of the women that they're seeing with newly diagnosed disease. I'm interested to know their perspective on the combination of olaparib, and probably we'll have niraparib too with bevacizumab. That data is coming. So PARP plus bevacizumab versus PARP alone. Do you think you need both? Are there any situations where you think you need both? Or is it just you're going to use one and save the one for later? How are people thinking about combination maintenance versus just one drug or the other in the community? And again, based on biomarkers, what people are thinking. And I'm also interested, this has been a fun conversation, to know how long people want to use maintenance. Solo was 2 years, Prima's 3 years. And actually, I was just told, I didn't know this, that they amended it to be just continuing. It is an incredibly high-risk population, Prima. So if you get to 3 years, maybe just like, no way, I'm stopping something that's working. But what do you think about that? And do you start to tailor even among BRCA-associated patients? Solo One had 44% of patients who were stage three, fully debulked, primary side reduction. Prima's the opposite spectrum, stage four, neoadjuvant. But both, if you have BRCA-associated cancer that looks more like a Prima-type population versus a Solo, are you going to be more apt to do 3 years? And I can't tell you that's right or wrong. I think we just don't know yet. So I'm really interested to know what people are doing with that data and how they're counseling patients about the length or duration of therapy in the frontline in someone who's otherwise responding, of course, because I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. I'm thinking about it.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Moore, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.